day, last day of the meditation retreat. And I guess you could say I have the good fortune to give a little bit of advice, and that would be to continue on with one's practice even after this retreat. So this practice we have to see as being very important to us. It's like breathing. We've heard the saying of when someone came to Venerable Ajahn Chah and asked, saying they don't have any time to practice. He said, if you have time to breathe, then you have time to practice. In other words, we have to see it as that important. We have to be practicing all the time. Can we say that the defilements, do they only come up when you're doing sitting meditation or when you're on this retreat, or can they come at any time? So we may have also heard the simile of that Ajahn Chah's given, that we've been planting a tree here. You maybe you've been doing it for these 7, 8, or 9 days of this retreat. But if you go and pull it out after 3 days and then you go plant it again, then Ajahn Chah said, if you practice 7 days and you don't speak and you don't play around, and then after you finish the retreat, then you do 6 months of completely sort of indulging in your senses, you don't have any mindfulness and restraint, he said, then you'll lose out on any gains that you've made. He said, it's kind of like you earned some money, say $50, and then you spend $70. And he said, oh, how will you save anything then? So today, just want to talk about sense restraint, being careful of your senses. You know, these senses of ours, you probably hear in every Dhamma talk, that our senses, they want stimulation. They're very hungry for it. It's like it's something that's always pulling us. These sights, sounds, tastes, odors, touch. And so these, the Buddha compares to being like 6 animals that are tied to a rope. And when we see something, a sight with lack of restraint, and then we grab onto the pleasant things of it or the unpleasant things, and then we like or dislike it, this is us not having mindfulness established. And so the Buddha compares it to if we had caught 6 different animals and we tie them up together, and then they all pull in different directions depending on where they want to go. He says there's a snake that pulls to this anthill, and the crocodile that pulls to the water, the bird that pulls to the air, the dog that pulls to the village, I think this jackal that pulls to the charnel ground, and the monkey pulls to the forest. And who wins? The strongest one. And this is like whichever one of our senses is most prominent, then it pulls us there and we can get caught into it. So we have to recognize this. And so, you know, do you notice how much these senses, they pull us? When there's that lack of mindfulness, then all things in this world can be a danger to us. It can harm us in that we can bring up liking and disliking for things, and then we go on attaching to them. So we're meant to be very careful of these senses, have sense restraint. Just like a turtle that pulls in all its feet and its head, and then the jackal that comes cannot eat it. And this is like Mara that is unable to get a hold or get an entry point to us because we've been restrained. And so all the different evil, unskillful qualities, they can't come up. So this is the drawback of not having mindfulness and clear awareness, is that we don't guard our senses. When we don't guard our senses, then we can have bad actions of body, speech, and mind. And this leads to the 5 hindrances. and then to ignorance. And so wisdom doesn't arise. So we have to pay more attention to our senses. And there's this story that comes to mind of how much the senses are pulling us, how much we seek this sort of sense stimulation, how much the mind craves for it and seeks happiness from it. There was once this Western monk, and he gave a talk in Wat Nongpapong in the Ajahn Chah Memorial. And this is on the night that is the night that Ajahn Chah passed away. So there's a commemoration. And if you've been there, they have Dhamma talks all night from the evening chanting, what is it, about 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, all the way till dawn. And so maybe 20 or so talks. And so this one Western monk comes up to give a talk. He's not that senior, but he goes up to give the talk, and the hall's full of people. There's a thousand or so, or a few thousand people inside the hall and outside the hall. It's being broadcasted everywhere. And it's about 2 a.m. and the monk starts to give the talk in Thai. And then after about 15 minutes, he starts to slow down, slows down, slower, until he stops speaking altogether. And then it was silent. Silent for 3 whole minutes, which felt like, I don't know, an hour. And everyone in this huge hall was awake, and they're practicing Nessa Chik, staying up all night. But every single person was awake, wondering what was going to happen. And we just kind of wanted him to say anything at all. You know, whether it was from the moderator, the senior monk who was leading it, who had the mic, or the speaker to start speaking again, but no one did. And so then 3 minutes into this silence, he starts speaking. And he says, what inspired me the most was when I watched the Ajahn Chah video, and Ajahn Chah says to let go. And, you know, when I don't know what to say, I have to let go. If you want me to say something, and you also have to let go. And, you know, a few other things, he said, you have to let go. And then he asked the crowd or the people listening, this is northeast of Thailand, you got to remember, very restrained, very, very respectful. And he asked, so what do you have to do? And I kid you not, people putting hands up in the air saying, let go, let go. And it's as if they had understood this Dhamma so deeply. And I think it was the most memorable talk of all that night. And I bet every single monk who gave that talk, who gave a talk on that night, the 20 or so talks, had probably said let go in their talk. And then realizing, oh, how much this mind craves this sort of sense object. You know, when you're focused on hearing, you're waiting for that sound, and it's kind of the mind is needs to be satisfied and hungry for it. And then you stop giving it that food, and you know, it's not used to it. And when it finally gets it, it's almost like grateful. It gets joy from it. You know, maybe all the other talks, the people were kind of dozing off, or they didn't really hear it. You know, but this one they fully heard, and it's remember it for me. So this is leading on to what we have to do is, yeah, let go of the cause of suffering, which is this craving for, you know, the craving for sensuality, or the craving for these sense pleasures. So this leads into where the Buddha talks about dukkha, how it arises and how it ceases. You know, dukkha is suffering, basically, you know, we've learned it, we're learning about suffering. And the Buddha says how it arises is in terms of the senses. There's an eye and a form, and there's eye consciousness. You know, we've heard this. And there's eye contact when the three come together. And then when there's a contact, then there's feeling. With feeling, there's craving. Right? That, he says, is the origin of dukkha. Then the Buddha says, there is dukkha that is, they say, disestablished. You know, how you break up dukkha is that when the eye, the same thing, the eye sees a form, the eye consciousness or cognition arises, then the all three together is that eye contact, there's feeling, feeling, there's craving. He says, but then with that craving, then through the fading away and quenching of that craving, then clinging or upadana or attachment is quenched, is put out. From there, then becoming, birth, all birth, aging, death, sorrow, grief, lamentation, pain, grief, despair is all quenched, put out, right? And so it's saying this is how we cease or give up or quench all the whole mass of dukkha or of suffering, just this way. And so this really brings of how we have to practice, how suffering arises from a cause, and that cause is conditioned, right? If we put down the cause, then the suffering is gone or disappears. So Venerable Ajahn Anand, he talked about this and talks about it often, about the most important thing of the practice. There was once an Indonesian lady who came to practice in Wat Mapjan, and she was a beginner, and she went to ask, you know, she wanted to know the core of the teachings, asking, you know, how should a beginner practice? And Venerable Ajahn Anand said, keep mindfulness in all postures. And then she asked, what is the most important thing to learn in this practice? And Venerable Ajahn Anand said, it's to keep the mind in the middle. Mei yin di, mei yin rai, which means not to like or dislike or no attraction, no aversion. And then she's still doesn't understand, so asking, oh, how do you practice this? And said, when either of them arises, this liking or disliking, attraction or aversion, then you have to see both as being not a sure thing, not certain, not permanent, impermanent. And so this comes to the heart of the practice, how you're going to continue practicing on from after this retreat in your daily life with all your experiences, sense experiences. And it means that you can practice this all the time. It's keeping this mind in the middle. So as a junior monk, I looked after, attended on Venerable Ajahn Anand from very early on, just after I ordained. And I was very happy that I could be of service. And for close to 10 years, I could do this. And it was it's a very great joy when I think back to it. And those times when you're close to Venerable Ajahn Anand, some people think, oh, it's very good, you get to be close. But actually, you really, really have to watch your mind, you know. You kind of don't want there to be any defilements coming up, or you have to be always with your meditation, you know, word or parikamma, you're always mindful there, being around. That's the type of feeling that you get. You have to put toe a lot. And so on some days, it'd be very, you know, busy. It would be a lot to do. And so it could be some days would be 6 in the morning all the way till midnight, is in having duties to do and to attend on. And, you know, there was especially some periods which were very busy, like Venerable Ajahn Anand's birthday, maybe you've been. That's a lot going on. And so during this period, I had to be really mindful of duties, but also mindful of the mind for long periods of time. And so there was this, I think it was the 60th birthday. And so one faithful lay devotee had offered Venerable Ajahn Anand some amulets, some somdet. I don't know if you know. So somdet do is pretty much maybe one of the most revered monks in Thailand. Everyone knows somdet do. It was around the 19th century. I only learned this after I ordained, but and he was very famous for making amulets. And these amulets, they said, well, are they really good? Or the monks would say, you know, you talk between monks and they'd say, oh, they can protect you from all sorts of things, accidents, bullets. And the radius of the energy it encompasses is like a whole elbow length around. It's sort of that much power energy in it. And so in Thailand, they're very rare and very famous, you could say. So having heard about this, when I had seen that there had a bag there, I thought, oh, you know, I really want one of these. You know, maybe I can give it to my father or something. He'd really, you know, like it or something. And so I just thought, you know, I just want one good amulet, that's all. But obviously this is just thinking. And so after the birthday, the forgiveness ceremony finishes, all the monks come down to the office, and there's the heads of the branch monasteries, the very senior monks, and they came to pay respects to Venerable Ajahn Anand and to before they leave and went back to their monasteries. And so there's that period. Ajahn Anand was giving out these somdets to these amulets to these senior monks. And I, you know, had this feeling come up, oh, you know, so I want that one. But I thought, oh, I can't, I have to restrain this desire, this feeling. So purposely just leave the room, you know, to go somewhere else to make sure that it wouldn't fall to defilements. You know, if you really fall to defilements, maybe it's not just thinking, it's actions and speech, or, you know, could I have one, you know, like this. But to try to train with it is to just, you know, put toe, whatever it is, not sure, you know, to leave that situation, circumstance. And so I left that, and then, you know, maybe and coming back later, and the amulets had been given out. And then the next day after the meal, there was someone who came to get their car blessed, and my duty to get a few of the things, like the blessed water for that. And next to it, the next morning, so next to it, I saw the bag of amulets was there, had a few left. And I thought, oh, you know, I have to again train with not having any desire or putting it down, basically, you know, letting it go, making sure it wouldn't come out in any thoughts, speech, or actions. And so later on, Ajahn Anand, he comes back inside and he'd finish his duties. And then he had picked up this bag of amulets and he called me over and said to me, close disciples get it last. They have to train themselves first. And so this was my feeling that, oh, this was the right way of practice. You know, maybe getting some encouragement that this is how you have to train and practice to let go of any of that desire or greed or defilements whenever the mind goes latching on to liking or disliking, and you bring it back to the middle. So hopefully that story emphasized the point of bringing the mind back into the middle, not liking, not disliking, and not the point that you should go out and try to get one of these amulets, somdets, or otherwise that's again the liking there, the desire, craving coming up. You got to go find one, and you got to get something to satisfy that desire. So Ajahn Anand, in regards to this, I guess he's said that, oh, some places they may make, you know, amulets to support the monks of the monastery, but the real amulet is the one that is made through stamping or molding the Kawat Paripada, which means the ways of practice, the trainings of this forest tradition. This is what will truly support the monk, or is going to be of true benefit. So this is what the monks sort of learn in the monastery, how to practice and to sort of train, and that's going to be the best support for us. So this is this practice of not liking, not disliking, something you got to work on, right? You practice this, maybe it's hard at first. Sometimes you lose out, you know, the teachers, Gurbaljan, sometimes compare it to even like challenging a heavyweight champion of the world in boxing, and you're just a new beginner. And so making patterns, sort of habits, these causal conditions to let go, to abandon that unskillfulness, it does take some effort, right? But it's actually not uniform in the way that every time it's hard like that. The first time you may be hard, there's a huge gap there, right? When you're not used to it, haven't trained in that way. But the second time it becomes easier. The third time is even easier, and the fourth time easier again. So in that way, that you could say the gap between nothing and one is very big, but the next gaps, first and second, are smaller and smaller in terms of making good karma, good habits, and training yourself. But the other side is also true, right? When you're making bad habits, you know, maybe now you've been restraining yourself already for, you know, 7 days, 10 days like this. You're really trying to give up unwholesome, unskillful qualities. Maybe you've stopped, you know, entertainment. You stopped, I don't know, speaking in certain, you know, certain ways. You've become very mindful. But, you know, you let go the first time, and then, you know, you stop maybe meditating, or you stop that schedule, or you start indulging in something that you used to indulge in, you know, then the second time becomes a lot easier. The third time, even easier. Fourth time, you're probably not even thinking about it anymore. So this is the nature how our bad habits start. And so don't throw away your practice, you know, keep it up. Don't think that, oh, I've been mindful for 7 days, and so now I'm gonna just let it go and take it easy. You know, don't throw it away. Otherwise, you'll fall into that bad habit. And so watching the mind, very important, keeping it in the middle. And so practicing like this close to Venerable Ajahn Anand, could say it's easy in a way, because, you know, when you're around a great teacher, you feel like you're more likely to do it. But actually, these sort of principles of how to practice, when you go elsewhere, you still practice the same way. So there was once went on Tudong, you know, Tudong, wandering around the north of Thailand. And over there, they call it Thuk Dong, which means suffering, or walking suffering, something like that. Thuk means dukkha. And so the hardships it brings of, like, you know, you're suffering in the sun, maybe walking the whole day, carrying heavy stuff, sweating, staying in a umbrella mosquito net, living off alms food, which is, you know, maybe you get a lot, maybe you don't, maybe you get enough, you don't, something like that, living completely off the villages. And so all this can bring up suffering. And so you endure it, and you become, you know, have more endurance to all those hardships. So I remembered, after having all this suffering, walking to, you know, where I was going, and then going past, the this village, you could say. And in this village, suddenly someone comes out of this convenience, kind of a mom and pop kind of convenience store, and goes, "Venerable, can I come offer you a Coke, a cold drink?" And I said, "All right, John Pon is like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, that'd be nice. Have this really cold Coke." And it's very, how do you say, satisfying, right? You've been walking all day, it's evening, there's no more arms, and you get this Coke, you're very happy, you know, delighted at having that. So when do you think was the next, or the hardest part of this Tudong, or the most suffering that came up? Was the hardship of the carrying stuff? No, it arose next day when You walk past this other village and you see in the side of your eye, oh, there's another store there. And then you think, oh, I've been walking all day, you know. And you remember the perception of yesterday, having that Coke and that good feeling. You know, maybe I should deserve it, or maybe I should, you know, out of the merit I've made, hopefully I'll get something. But actually you realize, oh, that time that when you have that expectation, that wanting for something, straight away you put yourself into suffering, right? And then what do you have to do? You've got to go work for that thing to go and satisfy that craving, that expectation that you created yourself. If you get it, then you are happy. If you don't get it, then you suffer. But this is the type of happiness that is relieving an itch that you created yourself by wanting that thing that you liked and desired. And so this is the nature of our existence, or even, you know, the cycle that we're going around in, that we're creating our own suffering from that expectation, craving, desires. Then we've got to go relieve it in order to feel happy or think we're happy. And then obviously that thing doesn't last. Then you've got to chase it again. So where are you ever going to get happy in this type of existence, you could say? So what do you have to do in that time, right? If it's following desires, obviously monks, we don't have money, so you can't just go and buy it. So, you know, if you really had desire, maybe you'd have to, oh, I have to slow down now, make sure they see me or something. I have to cross the road now. But of course, you know, learning and understanding of how to practice with it, oh, you have to walk faster, right? You have to use your mindfulness, your meditation a lot in order to overcome that desire, that liking for that, that you created yourself, you could say, from the defilements. So this is how to practice, you could say. You know, people doing this all the time, you have to have more awareness, attention to it. You know, like, why do people seek to go on holidays? You know, they go on holidays, they want to I'll enjoy that, I'll have a great time seeing that place, you know. And so they have to set up that desire, the expectation, then they got to work, go buy the ticket, prepare time, etc., and then go off there, see that thing, and then their desire is satisfied and they're happy, you know. Then what happens? You go back, you have to again go to the next place. It's this type of desire, right? So we are looking for peace or freedom from desire, not freedom of desire, right? The freedom of desire is you can satisfy your desires more and more and I'll be happy. But we're looking for freedom from desire, where you're putting down that freedom and that desire, and then there is peace. And so aversion as well, disliking works the same. There was once, I remember in Wat Mab Chan, there was this young novice and he wasn't there to practice. He just, I don't know how he could stay, this young, maybe 9-year-old or something, running around, and, you know, it's like, no, you have to be restrained. And so I was quite angry, upset kind of at this young novice. And then I had to come back again and think, oh, what if I died today? Would I be angry and irritated at this novice? And from there, this anger could disappear. From there comes up metta, goodwill, loving kindness. You can go up to him and pat him on the head, or, you know. So this is like another way, a tool, the mindfulness of death. So this mindfulness of death is something that the Buddha wanted us to reflect in this way of, you know, we reflect in the day or the night that today I may die. I may die of many different causes. He says maybe a snake, a scorpion, or centipede may bite us or sting us. I may stumble off a cliff, which these days probably means get into an accident. I could get food poisoning or suffer from some sort of bodily sickness and suddenly die. So we should, then the Buddha says, reflect, are there any bad, unskillful qualities that I haven't given up, which might be an obstacle to me if I die tonight or today, this day? And if there are, then we have to bring up great effort, perseverance, zeal, mindfulness, clear awareness, perseverance, in order to give them up, to let them go. The Buddha says, as if your clothes or head was on fire, that's the sort of effort that you would put. And the Buddha says, and if when you check yourself and there are no such bad, unskillful qualities, then you should meditate with rapture and joy and training day and night in skillful qualities. And so when we've sort of abandoned these unskillful qualities and there is unskillful qualities we've abandoned and there's skillful qualities in the mind, we can be happy and joyous in that, you know, this is something that will lead to samadhi, to concentration, and then to true knowing and seeing, understanding the Dhamma. So there was once when in Australia, and I was with another monk and was going into the
Steve, maybe you can turn this way a bit.
So, sorry, there was once in Australia, I was with another monk and we're going into the city and so we're going into for the alms round the next day in Bodhikasuma, and so we caught the train. And so we had to take two trains here, and the one we had got into was this silent carriage, right? And so it was half full and no one was talking in this carriage at all, right? And so as this train's approaching the station, we got to go and change trains, it starts to slow down, it's almost there, and we get up. And as we get up, we open this door to the middle carriage, which is kind of where the door is to get off. And as we open this door, then a female conductor, screams at us, saying, "Sit down. The train hasn't stopped yet." And straight away, come back to check the mind. Is there any defilement, any aversion or fear even, or irritation coming up? And there wasn't anything. And so it felt like there's nothing to do. You don't need to do anything with the mind. It was aware, it's clear-minded, mindful. And then I could look at her face and see, oh, this anger must be so much suffering. You know, they have to be suffering in order to do this, but also having compassion come up to her for being in that state, and could basically accept this situation for the way it is. You know, it's kind of correct in itself. It's, you know, we kind of suffer because we think it should be another way. But here, there was no sort of suffering there. So both of us didn't say anything. And we turned around to go sit back down in the seat. And I could see the whole carriage here was staring at this scene where this female conductor was screaming at two Buddhist monks in this silent carriage to sit down. And so basically we sat down. And we basically got almost straight away, had to get back up to get off the train because it completely stopped by then. And, you know, she had been right. There was a sign there saying, wait for the train to stop before getting into that middle carriage. And we would kind of say, she was correct but not right, or right but not correct, you know, because defilements came up. So anyway, but so we got off, and then the next train that we caught to go to the next station, and we were about to get there, I remember, and then the other monk was, I was like, all right, we'll get up at the same time we kind of did as it's slowing down. And the other monk said, no, no, he had to wait till the trains completely stopped before he got up. It's that kind of remembering of, you know, what had happened. So just share this story to illustrate that when we get more mindfulness and awareness of ourselves with this sense restraint, then we may not have any sort of liking and disliking arise at all. It feels like maybe we can let go of it, you know, whether it's instantly or quickly or more quicker than before. And maybe it feels like these sense impressions, contact, it doesn't really enter the mind at all. And, you know, whether it's good or bad, it doesn't sort of enter. The mind doesn't cling on to it, doesn't seek it. So I asked Venerable Ajahn Anand, it's like, if you feel quite peaceful and at ease, almost like it's emptiness there, that these mood sense impressions, they're not really entering, is it possible that it's just, you know, the moods have entered and we're not yet really aware of it? Is it possible? And he said, no, it's not possible, because this is when the defilements are present, then they proliferate onwards. They proliferate to having raga, from having raga, you know, greed, desire, then the mind will start to have indulgence in that sense object. If you have dosa, then there'll be anger, irritation, trying to get rid of that sense object. So what Ajahn Anand said then is that that type of, you know, feeling, being at ease, of not having this liking, disliking come up, is what he called meyindi, meyinrai, which is not liking, not disliking, the mind in the middle. And so it's like, you know, similar to upeka, bojanga, which is like the strength of equanimity that is growing. So if we're at ease, we can just be in that easeful state, right? And he said over a longer time, that samadhi will develop from that sort of easeful state, or the mind that has that sort of skillful quality. So this means that when we have these skillful qualities, this is coming back to how the Buddha is saying we can have rapture and joy in training in skillful qualities by day and night. So, you know, we shouldn't sometimes think, oh, we have to get rid of all desire and get rid of all suffering, but actually we have to also have happiness in these skillful states, which leads on to samadhi, which then leads on to the seeing of Dhamma, or understanding. So to end with, I remember when it was the Venerable Ajahn Anand's 68th birthday, and after the forgiveness ceremony in the Posada Hall, the monks and everyone comes down to outside the office, and outside the office here, the people had purchased 680 colorful birds, all in cages, for the Kripa Ajahn, Venerable Ajahn Anand to release. And so they put it there in front. Ajahn Anand would open the cage door, and then the birds would fly up. And it was quite a magnificent sight, you could say, all these colorful birds flying around to the forest. And the day after, coming back, and they put the cages, empty cages out there, put food and water in there. Some lay people had done that. And the birds, or, you know, there's quite a few birds that had come back in to the cages to have this food and water again, you know, to feed themselves. The doors open, they come back into the cage. And so this was kind of symbolic, almost, of Venerable Ajahn Chah's simile of the, we're like a bird in a cage, that we do everything in this cage. You know, we laugh, we cry, we happy, we suffer, we dance and sing, and everything in this cage. But we don't see the cage. And Ajahn Chah said, the cage is birth, aging, sickness, and death. And so the Kribajans, the great teachers, Venerable Ajahn Nun, he's telling us to come out of this cage, you know, not to settle for mundane pleasures or to be tricked by it, you know, not to attach to these things, as in see that being in this cage is suffering. You heard in a talk recently, Venerable Ajahn Nun saying, birth, aging, sickness, and death is like a cool fire. A cool fire means it's burning you, but you don't really see it as dangerous. You don't see it as being something that will really burn you. And so we have to see all phenomena being the way it is, according to the truth, seeing the impermanent, unsatisfactory, not self. And this is like seeing it, that these things are really hot and burning and dangerous, and they're burning with birth, aging, sickness, and death. At this is like we then see ourselves being trapped in this cage, and we see the drawbacks of ignorance, craving, and attachment, and we want to, nothing can keep us in this cage anymore. We want to leave it because we've seen clearly into these phenomena for what it is, for being, you know, it's like there's a simile where Ajahn Chah uses when someone comes up and says, oh, you know, it's hard to live the household life. And he says, it's easy to understand what to do, but it's difficult to do. And it's as if you're coming here to me and you're holding a red hot coal in your hands and complaining to me about it. You know, it's like, it's hot, you know. And this is like, I'll tell you, let go of it. But you're telling me, no, I don't want to let go of it. I want it to be cold, right? A hot burning coal, you want it to be cold. So if I tell you to drop it, it's either, you've got two choices. You either drop it or you must learn to be very, very patient. And so this is kind of like it, yet we don't yet see clearly this burning hot coal, and we're holding it and saying, what do I do with it? Well, I want it to be cold. But we have to see the drawbacks of it, seeing that actually it's hot, anywhere around this is hot. Seeing this, then there's a natural letting go. It's not a forced letting go or anything. It's a very natural thing you do because of seeing it the way it is, the nature of how it is, or we could say seeing the Dhamma. So I guess be responsible for your own happiness. You know, you have the capability to overcome the dukkha, the suffering in your lives, through your efforts, through your perseverance, and through your faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And you have that confidence that this noble eightfold path that the Buddha taught for sure is the path that will lead you to the end of dukkha, that the Kribajans, the great teachers, have walked already and put to the test, and encourage us to follow them, to come out of this cage of birth, aging, sickness, and death, and then gaining the freedom from all dukkha or suffering, freedom from all births in the cycle of samsara, to gain Nibbana. So may you all grow in your Dhamma practice. May you all realize all of your wholesome aspirations. May you meet and see the Dhamma and gain that true happiness, Nibbana.